Welcome, and thank you for joining us in the Restorative Lens podcast, where we bring together voices in the restorative justice community to share insight, practices, and perspective.
Each series of the Restorative Lens will be focusing on different topics within the field of restorative justice and give a space to hear from those who are most directly impacted or involved in the work.
The Restorative Lens is supported under the National Center on Restorative Justice, and we are your hosts, Alana Ojibwe
and Demoite Wesley. We're so excited to share this second series where we speak with facilitators from a recent National Center co-sponsored event. This event on equitable systems design for restorative justice provided an opportunity for participants to engage around key themes such as procedural fairness, access bias and decision-making, cultural competency, research and evaluation, policy and advocacy, and program implementation and fidelity.
The conversations in this series of the Restorative Lens create the opportunity to share some of these insights, reflections, and continued questions that came out of this event, as well as explore opportunities to address disparities within restorative justice implementation moving forward.
Thank you again for tuning in to the Restorative Lens, and we hope you enjoy listening.
This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.
So thank you again so much for joining us today for this conversation. 6 months later, after this initial Institute on Equitable Systems Design, and this session in particular, focusing on defining equitable systems, are really sort of at the heart of what came up from that conversation. So thank you again for joining us. And we wanted to just start by a question, introduction, who you are, where you're based, and something that's giving you a sense of hope or inspiration this week.
Sure. So Jonathan Schar, I am the director of the Restorative Justice Project at the University of Wisconsin Law School, which is a clinical program for law students, where the majority of our work focuses on a couple different areas. The sort of first and sort of most common thing that we work on are really going to be restorative dialogues, processes in serious and sensitive crimes, working with survivors and responsible parties and impacted parties of, again, things, sort of your highest order of crimes. And the other thing that we work on is also sort of in community, and that sense of partnering or collaborating with local nonprofits or local agencies who are doing restorative justice, both diversion work, but additionally just working in restorative spaces, whether that's sort of with youth or adjacent to, criminal legal processes, or working on direct diversion programs, or partnering with or attempting to do some amount of restorative collaboration with students working with different sort of schools or teachers or individual restorative practitioners in that sort of school-based space. There's been a little bit less of that. Certainly COVID pushed a lot of that sort of back and pushed us sort of out of community a lot just because of those spaces not being open. And so we're just sort of digging back into that work a little bit more as we had also developed a significant backlog of requests in sort of a serious and sensitive harm space. Because again, when we think about things sort of restoratively or think about restorative justice, sort of that idea of face-to-face and being present with individuals and wanting to, look someone directly sort of in their eyes rather than into, a webcam and experiencing that sort of presence and also providing the appropriate amount of support for individuals that exists, I think, in person to a very different degree than it does virtually. So, so we have a clinic that operates through the whole academic year and it provides incredible opportunities for law students to learn both about sort of our criminal legal processes and getting various different perspectives on that, especially, again, individuals who've experienced significant harm, but also seeing that other side, right? Individuals who are responsible for that harm that often, very likely also have deep traumas and deep harms that they've experienced that, they may have found themselves in that space and that have contributed significantly to the harm that they have passed on to, another individual. So, fundamentally, that's been about recognizing and holding this space for individuals on both sides of deep harm and deep hurt. And, you know, it is an absolute privilege to be invited into those spaces of the darkest and deepest things that people have experienced, as well as holding the humanity of those who are ultimately responsible for those choices and understanding who they are as people, and that sense of really loving everybody involved, right? Sort of loving both sides. Like, we can't engage in restorative practices without loving each other, which also starts with loving ourselves, right? And that sense of helping people find their value, their worth, defining their purpose, and then defining their future, right? Allowing them to be the architects of their own life. Rather than sort of the labels that we either place on them or that systems or system actors have placed on them, right? Really looking at accountability as liberation, right? In that sense of finding how do we allow for there to be a freedom that exists when we connect human to human, individual to individual. So that's really the heart of the work that we do here. You know, personally, I also do a fair amount of sort of consulting around the country on developing restorative programs and diversion programs, and working in or adjacent to criminal legal spaces or with legislation or providing guidance wherever I can to kind of anybody, whether again it's nonprofits or places looking to start restorative programming or looking to inject restorative justice into their local sort of justice economy, if you will, right? Or building things that are totally separate, right? Totally outside of that and new. And I really want to encourage people in that space, which is really what brought me into thinking about very deeply, you know, this concept around what does it mean to create equitable systems, and seeing the things that we sort of see, whether that's restorative justice diversion and all the different off-ramps, once somebody gets sort of captured by our criminal legal system, and the different places that they can be sort of diverted off of that space and into a restorative process, and thinking deeply around sort of the issues of bias that exist and how, you know, restorative justice, you know, like thinking like, is it immune, right? Or what makes restorative justice necessarily any different when you're reliant still on systems actors to provide access to the individuals, right? So that's sort of where I'm coming from when I think about this space. I've been thinking pretty deeply about that for a number of years, and I've been working on some collaborative writing with, again, incredible individuals, you know, around the country on that, and some incredible thought partners. So yeah, it's a lot of people thinking about this. And so when this conference sort of came up and thinking about, you know, again, defining and designing equitable systems, that idea of like the definition needs to come first, right? Like, what do we mean when we're sort of talking about an equitable system, like a system that recognizes people for one, their full humanity, but two, making sure that we understand what equity means. And that my concern is often that the way that programs get designed or the way that systems get enacted are, even if on their face, like, quote unquote, sort of equitable, the sense of how much artificial exclusion has occurred before anyone's even to a process, right? Or who even in the design process determines, right? The sense of who is worthy of restorative justice, right? That sense of thinking about all the sort of funneling or artificial funneling that occurs from any single interaction with the criminal legal system, right? Whether it's from initial contact with police all the way through to, you know, a prosecutor's office into the court system and where that goes for people. And so thinking about this idea of like all these upstream actors, and then also when you layer on top of that sort of the structural and institutional harm that people have experienced, as well as we look at sort of issues like DMC and how that's affected like youth, right? So the sense of we actually got to not only look at like, what is the picture right now, but what was the picture even 5, 10, 15 years before we even started thinking about designing a process or a system, right? That might've already started the artificial like, you know, funneling or excluding of individuals that we might say, oh, we're trying to serve particular populations, or we're looking to address elements of racial disparity or inequity in our system. But based on everything else that exists sort of culturally and systemically, excludes them without us even knowing, right? So that sense of really being intentional in thinking about that design space. And that's really been the focus of, as I'm talking with other programs or people are looking to build programs, we really got to think very carefully, very critically about all these sort of unintended consequences or all these unintended elements. Like, even when you're thinking about like what are, you know, criteria that we're going to use, like everything has eligibility criteria, right? So everything will need to be like, what defines this sort of scope of who comes to restorative justice? Because it's often, I mean, really the sense of, as a practitioner or as a program or a diversion program or a nonprofit, very rarely is it sort of like individual sort of self-referring, right, to a restorative process, right? It's individuals with power and authority, right? So we think of our state or system actors, of law enforcement to prosecutors, making those decisions, right, of potentially who gets to restorative justice, that then has to layer on top of, again, all those things when we look at what are the criteria, right? Whether it's first offender or no juvenile history or significant juvenile history or no violent juvenile history, or like what charges are eligible or what is not eligible. Thinking about all the factors and all the places where bias creeps in to those decisions to determine ultimately who has an opportunity for restorative justice. Because I come to this space, it's like, okay, hey, we're looking to build a restorative justice program. Like, okay, great. Like, what is the issue that you're trying to address, or what is the population that you're trying to serve, or what are you trying to do? Because answering those questions fundamentally will then lead to a very careful analysis of, all right, well, how do we re-engage with individuals that might otherwise be excluded, who you want to serve but aren't because of criteria that you may not even be aware has artificially excluded individuals, right? So that's sort of when I think about this, really at this kind of high level, it's some of that stuff. And then really diving deep into sort of common selection criteria and sort of common elements and things of this, really the fallacy around race neutral, criterion elements. And like I said, thinking about the ways even in which our systems operate that are discriminatory, exclusionary, and fundamentally inequitable. So looking at all these different places and spaces where it can exist, trying to shift us further and further upstream to restorative justice, right? Because as soon as someone gets into a system, it's much easier to just continue passing along. And even when we think about designing restorative justice systems to help our criminal legal system or our systems, you send cases or you divert more cases, well, then you'll have more time. Well, unfortunately, the way that like the human brain works is that the busier someone is, the less amount of time and space they have to think critically about individuals, about issues or particular cases or about situations. And so it's just easier to process what we've always processed, right? So like doing something new or even if ultimately it would save me more time, it's not the way that humans work, right? So understanding some of that critical function is that even if they might say, well, geez, we could reduce our trial load or our caseload or reduce the workload in a prosecutor's office by 30 or 40% by looking at diverting those cases. When individuals in those spaces are already feeling like they're underwater, they don't have time to deal with the caseloads that they have, it's still easier to sort of just like pass it along to the next hearing, pass it along to the next thing or the next person or the next step, because that's routinized, right? And so that sense, if we actually want to think about change and fundamentally shifting what that looks like from a systems-based perspective, we have to then think about how do we instead routinize restorative justice that then again captures what we're actually attempting to capture. Because again, our outputs are only going to be as good as our inputs. And so I think a lot of times we've been operating, even as, again, and think about this, right? Like look at the profound results that we've seen in the empirical studies around the effectiveness of restorative justice on a variety of metrics. So we know what that data says. Now, let's start having this like sort of second and third layer conversation that says, hold on, wow. So if we're still subject to the same sort of systemic elements that other diversion programs are subject to, right? The sense of the artificial excluding of individuals or the ways in which we're not capturing the entire group that we could, or, because we're operating in a too narrow of a band, or again, people were already excluded because of stuff that happened 5 years ago and we're not recapturing them. Like how much more of an impact like could we be having? Right. So again, as I started to think about that, I was like, geez, I'm frankly shocked to see the effectiveness levels that we've seen in restorative justice when it's still subject to the same other systemic factors that, that impact all this sort of both upstream and downstream elements of individuals.
Well, thank you so much I think you covered probably 10 of the other different questions in different ways. You covered a lot in just that first response. So thank you so much. And there's a lot more as follow up. I think I'm sure that both of us have to piggyback onto that. But I'm curious, again, whether this is connecting to sort of your broader work or anything that comes to mind from the conversations during the Institute itself, knowing that, as you describe, there's so many different points within the justice system that restorative justice may come into play. And knowing that has very different sort of trajectories of outcomes. And like you said, the outcomes are really influenced by the inputs. So this conversation around defining what equity looks like is a really hard starting point because you don't know, you don't share necessarily the same starting point. So whether that's community-based versus pre-adjudication, you know, it's like every single part, it's really different conversation of what equity looks like. So I'm curious, knowing that there's not one answer to this, curious what came up in conversations, again, either in the Institute or just in your work in general, in terms of common themes or characteristics that do exist when people try and define equity. And whether that's in the context of restorative justice or in general, I think it's easier to think of what injustice and inequity and marginalization looks like, but to try and focus on defining what are some of the core qualities or characteristics of what equity does look like or could look like. Did anything come up or emerge that were sort of common themes around that?
Yeah, and interestingly, right, I'll give a little bit of an anecdote that I've sort of done in other trainings, and you're sort of touching on this, right? It's a sense of we often are forced with some of these nebulous concepts, right? Like even justice, right? Or equity, by defining them by their antithesis, right? It's a sense of like, I can recognize when something is unjust, right? And I can recognize if something is inequitable. But it's actually much harder, right, sometimes to sort of to name and really, because that's a feeling, right? Like the sense of like, we can feel, like we can know when things are wrong, right? It's a lot harder sometimes in a lot of ways to think about, well, what is the positive, right? Like, what is this actual piece? And so one of the first questions that we asked our group to look at wasn't thinking about this, is it's sort of like, well, what are the places or spaces or traits that you witnessed in places that felt equitable? Right. And those could be both within restorative justice spaces or any other place, right? Like it didn't have to be related to restorative justice. And so some of the common sort of like top level themes that ultimately when we sort of, you know, moved responses into sort of some more definable categories, I think some of the ones that really stood out are around interdependence, right? That sense of recognizing the interrelationship between individuals that is also related to this concept in restorative justice around right relationship, right? The way that we are connected to one another, that has sort of another top element was sort of voice and choice, right? That sense that gets to the heart, I think, of providing voice and space for everybody. And that sense, that means intentional inclusion, right? Because it's, again, it's hard to sort of say, again, we know what exclusion looks like, but that sense of intentionally pulling in voices, right? Especially marginalized voices, needs to be an element that exists in thinking about if we're going to define or design something, right? Because I can only know things from my lens, right? And so it's a sense of, I look at it based on my own experience, my education, my own positionality, all of those things that sort of create my identity, that those elements of identity shape my lens. And so that sense of, okay, well then how do we make sure that we're creating space and actively including, right? That sense in allowing people to have voice and expanding that in community. You know, we run into this a lot, especially when we think about systems and structures of power, right? Whether we're talking about local, you know, city government, county government, state government, whatever, that sense of the places of and spaces of power and who holds those, right? And what we need with restorative justice is, quite honestly, is like we have to have those individuals relinquish that power, surrender some of that power to community. And so it's looking at what they're comfortable with, but then pushing them into a space of uncomfort, which says like, well, we also need to have more voices here. And then there also has to be the element of choice. That's not like, well, we'll invite to the space, but as soon as we disagree with you or as soon as you disagree with us, well, then it gets shut down, right? And that sense of choice relates to consent, right? And the sense of like, there is very little that happens in our criminal legal system that has anything to do with consent. Like once you're in it, you're in it. Okay, you sort of lose all control over that. And so that sense of thinking about, well, what does an equitable system look like? Like, what is a trait? Well, I think choice is important, right? That people can decide what is sort of right for them and have that active ability to participate in the way that they want, in the way that sort of is safe for them and is comfortable for them, that embraces them and their identity and allows them a platform to have voice is also really important. But that pulls in, right, these sort of things on the either side of like a right relationship, as well as the recognizing the interdependence that exists, right? This sense of that we, as we exist in community, however that is defined, right? From the local to the more broad, that it is a piece that, again, we often want to suppress because it's all about sort of control. But when we instead really look at it in this space of recognizing the interdependence, that was sort of, again, sort of three of the big keys that we saw. And another was solidarity, which again, I think is similar, right? Like in these sorts of messages, thinking about like, all right, well, great. So, you know, in our right, when we're in right relationship, that means even if we disagree, it's still like, I'm still here for you. I'm here to support you. Like we can be in disagreement and not necessarily be separated, right? Like we can even fundamentally disagree over some particularly important things, but still there's a sense of like, we're still moving towards a common goal that we support and that we're shooting towards the same ends, right? That we're looking to define and build something different. And so that sense of looking at an equitable system, I think all those things are there. So those are the sorts of spaces or things that you know, the general categories of what people sort of said, like, what does an equitable space look like? It looks like a space where people are in right relationship, experiencing joy, in solidarity with one another, that everybody has a voice and has a choice to how they participate and what that looks like for them, and recognizing the interdependence between individuals. So that sense of, you know, again, whether we call that under the large umbrella of just like, well, relationship, right? Okay, well, that's, you know, sort of very restorative. But I think it is important to look at some of those sort of themes and recognize that was a piece that came out from community. And then from there, you know, we also looked at sort of what are some of the obstacles then to sort of, if we're going to look at building an equitable system, and we look at this element of relationship, then it sort of set up some dynamics or things that are potentially opposed to one another. And, you know, sort of one of these hurdles can be, again, sort of the political will, right, or cultural will that may exist in a given area, community, jurisdiction, however you know, want to define where you're looking to do something or where you're looking for something different or new to happen. And that sense of allowing for a space of truth telling, and allowing for inviting of communities, hearing, seeing, recognizing, acknowledging, compensating, and granting power, right? Like those are sort of the first steps. But then it can't just be, all right, thank you for your input. Now, you know, go on your way and we'll take it from here, right? The systems, the professionals sort of will take it from here, right? There still has to be, this process that exists. And there was a term that came out during the session called conscious co-creation, right? And so I think about that, right? In that sense of all of us still working together. And the opposite to that is really unconscious creating. And that's just like, okay, well, we're going to copy paste, or we're going to do the same thing with RJ that we do with our sort of other diversion programs, or we're just going to, again, we're just going to adopt or take another program. You know, we're going to look at their model and we're just going to bring that here. That's what we're going to have, without necessarily thinking about, again, well, what are the flaws? Right? Like what has worked or what maybe doesn't work? If things are working, why are they working? Understanding there's a sense of when you look at restorative justice, like there's a sense of due diligence that has to happen on the ground locally. I even talk about that. Like whenever I'm looking at consulting, this sense of like, look, I'm not going to know your community. There are things that I can know and there's guidance that I can provide, but there's information that you also have to give me. That again, if we are going to consciously co-create these sorts of things together and think about things in these sort of spaces, then I also need to know, like, not just, you know, more broadly, but really diving deep to what does it look like on the ground where you are? And what does it look like locally? And thinking about what are your supports? Where are your allies? What are your resources? And thinking about then, okay, how do you engage all of that? So that we don't lose critical parts or critical voices that need to be involved in the conversation when it comes to thinking about creating something, right? And again, like I said, I'm going to hope what we're working towards is creating equitable systems, right? But I'm not going to make that as the assumption, because that there's so much where we've seen where we know that it's not, right? And the data also in sort of, at least here in the US, doesn't exist in a lot of the spaces where we need to, I really think, accurately define, you know, some of the problems or defining how big some of the problems are when it comes to what does this look like in diversion spaces, right? So what is sort of elements of bias, or what does that look like? Like kind of how bad is the problem, right? Or what are we seeing, even in restorative justice? And the answer oftentimes is we just don't know, right?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that response. You've given us a lot to think about in terms of, yeah, what exactly do we mean when we are talking about equity, which can feel a bit vacuous. Something I'm curious about And we can go however broad or as deep as we want to with this question. When we talk about, you mentioned sort of intentional inclusion, right? Intentional co-creation, intentional like centering or bringing in voices that have been traditionally marginalized. To be frank, it feels like we are in a point in US history where a lot of the efforts that maybe have sought to drive towards equity are being rolled back, right? In the name of something more like equality. So I'm thinking in particular of the Supreme Court striking down affirmative action, right? Which is a policy that, again, I think in its intention, meant to sort of balance the scales. So understanding that, you know, that is sort of away from restorative justice, but nothing, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. Yep. I'm wondering, in this particular like political time, how do we push for more equity in our systems when we're working with system actors, when we're working with state actors in this time where sort of intentional inclusion, intentional centering of marginalized voices and experiences is in many ways being rolled back.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of pushback against that. Just curious about any thoughts that you have around that.
I mean, in a lot of ways, disappointment, right? In a lot of ways, it's a sense of, you know, looking at, you know, that we don't exist as sort of an ahistorical body, right? When we think about that sense where there is, instead, that sort of feels like the direction that things are moving a little bit. You know, that sense of that in fact, we can acknowledge and exist within our histories when we're actually looking towards our future. And again, I mean, again, we could go back to so many analogies, right? Of like, you know, those who fail to acknowledge the past or the mistakes of the past are doomed to repeat them. You know, to thinking about the ways, I mean, there's, so before I address that, I also want to, one other point I think that is important around sort of the intentional inclusion is also this idea that exists, right? Sort of tokenism, right? The sense of that we got to make sure that that's also not happening, right? And so it's, how do we gird against some of these sort of additional elements that, you know, let's say sort of in dominant culture, right? Or dominant systems of power and structures in government and in the law or legal systems, you know, how do we address some of those things? I don't have a perfect answer. It's like, hey, how do you do it? Geez, I don't know. If I knew, you know, I would be shouting that from the rooftops, right? If I sort of knew what the specific way forward was. But it is that sense of when we look at or think about even these sort of ideas of the way, how does, you know, white supremacy culture sort of seep in to various things? But that's really about power structures, right? In that sense of, it's really about looking at, again, this idea of history, not necessarily needing to deny it. We can acknowledge that it is a thing, okay, that there are things that have happened. It doesn't necessarily mean anything bad. Like, the acknowledgement is important, right? And so that sense of how do we move to continue to sort of try and center voices is to continue to try and center voices, right? So it's finding finding allies and spaces and utilizing specifically individuals in positions of power or with an outsized voice of then doing that lift, right? So a sense of like, it requires allyship, right? It requires like, what does that mean though, right? So that means sort of elevating, creating and sacrificing space, voice, air, time, right? To leverage, you know, whatever social capital an individual has to be able to make sure that we're sort of not silencing ourselves either, right? In these ways of utilizing what is the voice that I have and how do I utilize that? But it is concerning, you know, as I think about a lot of the things that, you know, that we're seeing or the ways in which you know, stuff is changed, right? It feels a little bit like a sea change. And so it feels like what it means is actually we got to work a lot harder now, you know, for that. And so I don't, you know, think it's a time we need to talk about it more rather than sort of talking about it less. And so that the idea of, I sort of describe it as sort of intentional design. In thinking about this idea that anything we do without deep intention is going to be bound to have many, many unintended consequences, or we're just going to replicate existing harms, right? Like, we're not actually going to build or create something new and effective that also, again, can be paying attention to this idea of of equity. And yeah, I mean, where we go, I don't know, right? I think that's sort of something that we're going to sort of see. But it's not a time for people to be silent. It's not a time for people to sort of stop working or fighting. It's time to continue to, find allies in different spaces. And whether you're looking to build systems, thinking about like, where are some of those access points, right? And how do I, bring different people on board? So yeah, I said, I wish we were in a different position that sort of says we didn't have to work so hard to answer that question. But that might be one of the most challenging things that you could possibly ask me today, right? Because I don't have a crystal ball, right, as to where we're going, culturally, societally. We can only think about it as like, I can only determine where I go individually, right? And who do I help come along for the ride, right?
Thank you. So I think that's a good segue actually for this next question, which is another sort of $1 million, no correct answer question. So without the crystal ball, we're going to hand you an imaginary magic wand. And picking one of those themes you had mentioned earlier that came out of the conversation, could be solidarity, could be interconnectedness. There was another one.
So the voice and choice and the right relationships were the other ones.
Yes. There was something about, a theme of your choice that could be a better reflection of what equity within our systems, particularly a justice system, could look like. And if you imagine you had the magic wand could wave and sort of bake in that theme to an individual. So I picture someone moving through our justice system at, let's just say, the point of a charge, or choose where they are interacting or intersecting with our justice system. And they are gifted through this magic wand, the experience of one of these themes to move through our justice system, at least in that one component, in a more equitable way. What are some of the things that come to mind that would look like for that individual? So if you imagine what solidarity would look like moving through that system for an individual, interconnectedness, what are some of the things that come to mind that in a dream world, if you gift someone one of those key ideas that came up, what could that look like for an individual?
So first thing, so we can't do the wishes for more wishes sort of thing, right? I can't use the wand to get more wands. So we're going to set that aside. I would just say, what would it look like for that person going through the system? Well, what it would look like is the person not going through that system. I mean, that's 100% what it would look like, right? Because there would be recognition. And that's I would say is it wouldn't be any of those things, right? Yeah. It would be recognition of their fundamental humanity, right? Seeing them as your brother, as your sister, seeing them as you, right? That sense of recognizing them fundamentally. There was sort of just work that I've done in prisons, and I had, again, great fortune to spend a lot of time working in a prison program where often defined it as I would be there, that sense of, I think, what restorative justice fundamentally, both sort of in groups, but the space is like, sort of like an eye exam where it's like, look, I'm a nearsighted individual, right? So people that are far away, they're kind of fuzzy. Right. So I don't really know them. Can't really see them. Like, I got like kind of a rough outline, but like, can't really define the features. Can't really know who they are. But like, restorative justice, what they allows me to do is to see you, right? To see you clearly, to see your outline, to see your definitions, but also to see your deep humanity, to see your, like, your crevices, to see your cracks, to see your flaws, to see your beauty, right? In a very different way that we don't see when we're looking at things in a different way. So it's about recognition. Like, that is what that person would get. Like, in order for them to receive equity, to experience equity through the system, they first have to be recognized. One, as a human. Two, as a worthy human. Like, three, and as a person with value, right? Like, those things are there, that they see them for who they are. And also not just who they are, but who they can be. Because that is another really important thing, that we're not locked in our present. Instead, we have to be focused on our future, right? And where do we go, right? And then how do we get there, right? So then it's a sense of like what that person experiences with recognition is it gets someone that says like, I'm going to take your hand, right? And I'm going to walk with you. And again, you know what, like I said, I'm going to turn around. We're going to walk away from the system that exists, right? And we're going to walk towards something different in one that means sort of walking beside them. And that's why I said, like, I find it such a deep and profound honor, right, to work in these spaces of serious and sensitive crime. Like I said, it is a true gift to walk with someone, to find their path of healing, for them to help divine what their path looks like forward to get to a better place, right? To take deep woundedness and to stitch that up and to turn it into something beautiful. Recognizing that we then become woven as a tapestry. You are now in my circle of concern. Like, I think about you and your family and your kids and the people you've lost. You are part of me now, right? Like, so there's a sense of, so like I said, it wouldn't be any of those things, right? It would actually start with recognition. And from there, right, we would walk together in, I guess, solidarity then into that space. But again, recognizing and seeing who that person is at all phases of their life, right? Like, who were they as that four-year-old, right? Who witnessed what they witnessed in their home? Who were they at seven when they went to school and experienced bullying? Who were they at 12 when they weren't experiencing sort of having fundamental needs met? Like, who were they at 15, right, when their heart was broken, right? Like, the sense of recognizing all these parts of a person and that we're all very complicated and complex. You know, it's one of the things that I find amazing about sort of doing community-based trainings that I do, of bringing together, again, 15, 20, 25 strangers, that when we sit in circle and we, you know, and I'm able to facilitate conversations, you know, around who they are and around what brought them there, what is their purpose, the deep connection that is formed, right, that they're like, geez, I feel closer to you after 2 hours, you across the circle from me than I've ever felt to half the people in my family. Right? Because we're here listening and seeing each other, right? So we're going to walk, right, to a different place that usually is going to have a circle involved, right? We're going to be able to have the pleasure and privilege of listening and deeply listening and also deeply seeing, right? So it's that eye exam to see you for you, right? To see all the parts of you, right? And for it to be safe, actually, for you to share those parts of you with me, right? That I will be accepting of who you are, regardless of what I think or where I come from or how our experiences are different. Instead, we're going to be looking for the things that overlap, right? Think of the ways in which our lives interweave with one another. Like, those are the things that we need to do, right? Like, that's what that looks like, right? So then when you think about, we focus on healing, we sort of focus on, if you know, that's going to be kind of our North Star, so to speak, right? How do we design something that looks like that,
right? That is such a beautiful vision, and a possibility, right? That is something that we can actually see, not easily, as you've laid out for us. It is going to take a lot more work, even though so much work has been done, so much work that you are doing in this world. And speaking of which, I want to give you the last word just to tell our listeners, how can they support the work that you are doing? How can they connect to you and the work that you're doing?
Sure. I mean, certainly they can reach out. And if people have questions, they want to sort of learn more about what we're doing, you can come sort of check out our, you know, sort of the clinic website. You can email me. Again, there's a number of places I'm working even around the country right now. In looking at what is, you know, building systems look like, or what does it look like in your place? Obviously, I have limited capacity to do so, but hey, I'm always happy to help where I can. I certainly should probably say no more, but unfortunately or fortunately, it's too important, right? Sort of what we're doing. You know, there are individuals certainly that financially support the work that, you know, that we're doing, you know, to provide services to survivors of serious harm and serious crime. You know, we work with again, victims or survivors of serious harm. Really, you know, we've worked, I clients that are kind of all over the country, even internationally, where the person responsible, right, maybe for harm is here, sort of like in our state, whether they're incarcerated or in our communities, that there is an option or an opportunity for them to sort of look at that. And so if you're looking to craft a program around, again, sort of like serious and sensitive crime work, post-adjudication stuff, corrections-based things, again, I've had a blessed journey, right? In the way that I feel incredibly fortunate, incredibly privileged to have the opportunity to work in schools, to work in community, to work in diversion, to work in prisons, to spend time in deep relationship with our clients, to walk beside them, And so I'm happy to help anybody that I can that wants to also sort of do that, to think about envisioning, right? Like, let's co-create, because the sense is, like I said, so the day to day is really heavy and is really deep. And so that sense of what helps bring me the creative energy, that helps sort of fuel some of that is being able to work in some of that design space to envision something different, to say like, look, I don't like what I see right now. So how can we build something new? And yeah, so there's lots of ways you can support us, right? From, I guess you can't find us on Facebook anymore because apparently the Facebook algorithm said that we're not actually who we are. Like as the Univee official Restorative Justice page was taken down. And you know, I don't know, it's what happened. But yeah, you can look at our website. You can, again, certainly reach out to me via email. And again, there's sort of limited, I do consulting, you know, kind of anywhere. Obviously again, sort of limited capacity on those sorts of things, but there's lots of ways that reach out. I'll tell you, you want to support us, I will tell you how you can do it. You know, we can have that conversation because even there, I want to know, like, what do you think that looks like, right? Like, what best serves them, right? Like, what do you want to help? I got a buffet, right? And if that's like supporting and doing work sort of more nationally, or again, just sort of providing support services to our survivors of crime, you know, allowing for additional resources to get records and allow for, you know, things like ASL translation, to allow for interpreters, to allow more people to have access, right? That is sort of the biggest issue. And unfortunately, access equals dollars. Right. And so the sense of allowing people to do this and also capacity, that's sort of the same sort of thing, right? Like I'm just one person. And so again, I have incredible clinical students who work with me, who do incredible work and their clients are so grateful for them. You know, there's that sense of that, yeah, that there's always more work to do. And so I think there's a lot of things that people can do, and whether that's supporting you in your local community, or wanting to, again, be a thought partner, reach out.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, you're welcome.
This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.